Basel III Endgame will make it harder for consumers to buy a house or a car. It'll hurt the small businesses that rely on loans to grow, and it'll reduce savings for people with money in pension funds. Regulators propose capital requirements would take a toll on families, seniors, farmers, and small businesses. Washington, scrap Basel III Endgame and start over.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, as the shutdown turns, heading into a fifth week, there are not many signs there's any progress to ending the partial government shutdown. But we're going to hear from one of our reporters about why Washington area TSA agents might actually hold all the cards and when this gets resolved. Plus, if you had any doubt that the 2020 campaign has begun, put it to rest because we've gotten three more candidate announcements about campaigns and exploratory committees in just the last 7 days. And we've got more to come later this month. We've got candidates flooding into Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada soon. It's happening. So we're going to talk all about that. As always, before we begin, a note, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, January the 17th. So it's all up to date as of then. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian in the studio. Charlie, good to have you.
Hi, Scott.
We have Nancy Cook, our Politico White House reporter and Nerdcast regular. Hello, Nancy.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And I want to welcome in a member of our congressional team on the line from the Capitol, Sarah Ferris, making her Nerdcast debut. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, thanks. Happy to do so.
Thank you so much for joining us. Time for our first data point, 38. As in 38 years, the amount of time it's been since a president didn't give an in-person State of the Union address to Congress. And it looks like we might not get to 39 because House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is saying that Donald Trump should reschedule the speech if the government is still shut down come January 29th, which is when this year's State of the Union is scheduled for. Now, Pelosi cited security concerns because Homeland Security and Secret Service officials are affected by the shutdown. That is a stretch. The real thing is this is a sign of just how much the acrimony between Trump and Democrats is increasing as they dig in over the shutdown, which, as we said before, is heading into the fifth week. So, Sarah, we'll start with you. Big picture, is there an end in sight? And what has Congress been doing, if anything, to break the logjam here and try and get the government reopened?
Well, I'll put it this way. I just talked to Hal Rogers, a Republican from Kentucky, who has been serving in the House for several dozen years, and he told me he's never seen something as dire as this, where there is literally no end in sight. He just told me that a couple minutes ago. So that's for perspective of how badly things up here are going. In the House, Democrats have just been churning through spending bills. They've been putting everything in the kitchen sink on the floor, trying to get some Republican defectors. Republicans have been pretty strong on that. It's actually been pretty remarkable how few Republicans have gone for these bills, considering how long the shutdown has been lasting. And then in the Senate, there's been a desperate flurry of action trying to create some momentum, but that has hit a very large concrete, maybe steel wall over there, and it's just a complete disaster.
And the Senate isn't picking up any of these bills that House Democrats are passing, right? Senate obviously controlled by Republicans, Mitch McConnell.
Correct. And there's been a lot of attention about how Mitch McConnell has taken himself out of the talks on this. This is not because he's personally trying to avoid the issue. This is because he's already done what he could do. He put a bill on the floor that would have funded the government. This was back when before the government had shut down. And he did his best, and Trump changed his mind. And so he's not going to be putting bills on the floor that don't have support from the president. I mean, he's already been embarrassed on this already. So the only thing he will put on the floor that he would make his members vote for, some of whom are pretty vulnerable in the next cycle, is going to be a vote that has been specifically, explicitly endorsed by Trump. Probably they'll probably need a tweet before they actually vote on it.
Right. So, Nancy, then do you get us up to speed on what the team at the White House has been doing this week? You've done some digging on how the administration is, while holding the line on getting funding for a border wall, which is the whole reason this shutdown is happening, the administration has been taking some steps to try and ease the pain from a shutdown as they feel political pressure For this happening, as we've seen in recent polls.
Yeah, so Trump has really dug in, you know, I've been told, and doesn't really, doesn't like the negative coverage that he's getting for it, but also has really dug in on getting the border wall funding. So basically what the administration is doing, you know, and aides are getting worried. You know, we've seen stories this week by my colleague Ben White about how this the shutdown and sort of the prolonged economic effect of this could really hurt any economic expansion this quarter, which is a key argument for the White House heading into 2020, that Trump is presiding over the great economy. And so White House advisors are starting to get nervous. And so what is happening is basically they are finding creative ways to reopen parts of the government. And they would say that, you know, they're doing this within the boundaries of the law. You know, this happened. There was a long shutdown during the Clinton presidency in 1995, 1996, not as long as today's. But they're looking back at all these legal opinions from that. And a senior administration official I talked to yesterday called those opinions sort of the guiding light. But what they're doing is they're recalling thousands of federal workers from the IRS, the Agriculture Department. You know, so they're recalling thousands of workers, reopening a lot of different services that they had shuttered. These workers, though, I should note, are coming back to work without pay.
Right. So when that happens, they're designated as essential, right? Is that that's what that's called? And so that they have to show up to work, but they will presumably get back pay when this is all over. But for now, there's nothing showing up in their paycheck.
Exactly. So no one's getting paid. But what agencies are doing is they're classifying more and more workers as essential, which basically makes them come back. And the agency that's sort of in charge of all of this is the Office of Management and Budget. You know, they are part of the executive branch of the government, part of the White House. And they're basically, they have to sign off on all these decisions. And, you know, critics would say, and lawyers would say, some lawyers would say, they're really pushing the boundaries legally of what is possible. And they're going to get into trouble after this is all over. We already saw some of that yesterday. Some House Democrats on the Congressional Committee that oversees the Interior Department really went after the Interior Department because the Interior Department was recalling workers who were involved in offshore drilling projects. And they were saying, you know, that's not essential. And basically the standard is like you can recall workers or reopen services to protect property and to protect people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so Democrats are really glomming onto that. And even some Republicans, and they're saying, well, you know, all these different workers that are called back don't fit that designation. And they're basically saying that Trump is playing political games with the shutdown by, you know, trying to play to his base by reopening services that could help people to sort of save face himself.
Meanwhile, we've been talking the last few weeks about what, you know, what some of the effects were going to be of the shutdown as it dragged on longer and longer. One of them was obviously the missed paychecks for government workers. But the team at Politico Pro that covers all these different policy areas has put together a really long list of some of the specific ways that the shutdown is affecting people. They say more than 10,000 government employees have applied for unemployment benefits. There are some screening lanes at airports have been closed, and security lines have been getting really long because of absences by unpaid TSA agents. A lot of USDA offices around the country have been closed, so there have been problems for farmers trying to get resources for financing for spring planting. Federal courts are set to run out of funding on Friday. That could be an interesting one to watch. And meanwhile, Charlie, Politico ran a story this morning, and in the backdrop of all this, Donald Trump's 2020 reelection campaign is spinning up. And this is – Trump is obviously embracing the wall as a key issue both in the shutdown negotiations and for his reelection. But these kind of effects of a shutdown are really not what they were banking on to be kind of – grappling with as they got the reelection effort off the ground.
Right. And in a lot of ways, the politics here are reversed from a traditional president, I think, because right now, if you take a look at what's happening, virtually all the polls are in agreement that Republicans are losing this here in terms of the PR war. And one of the reasons why we're at a standstill is because, unlike in the past, where as soon as it became clear somebody was losing, you know, one of the parties, they would buckle, find a solution, and end it. But here's the problem. Donald Trump and the Republican Party is perceived as being on the defensive here and that they're at fault and the public isn't thrilled. But for him to get reelected, he absolutely cannot cave on this issue because of the unique nature of his coalition, meaning he is not running as a president who's going to try to win reelection with 50% of the vote. There's not going to be a mandate. There's not going to be a landslide reelection like Ronald Reagan in 1984. It is going to be hand to hand. It's going to be bloody. It's going to be ugly. He's going to get no more than he got in 2016. So he's going to be in the mid to low 40s, and that's how he's going to win. And so that means it is essential that he holds his entire base, and that is the, you know, anywhere from 35 to 40% of the American public that will stick with him no matter what. And he also has to keep Republicans placated as well. And the key here is he can't buckle on the immigration issue, which seems which to many Republicans is really the most important issue. And he certainly can't cave because of the way his base views him as somebody who's a bit of a maverick and will stand up to the establishment, things like that. So he's sort of locked into a position where he can't move without threatening his own prospects in 2020.
There's a curious thing in a few of the polls that are out, and it's just a couple polls, and it's I'm curious to see if this persists, but there were a few polls that showed his approval rating going down during the shutdown, but the percentage of people who strongly approve of him actually ticking up a little bit, right? And that I feel like that gets to this kind of the perverse incentives there, right? Because it's firing up his base while dragging down his overall popularity so far.
Right. And I think the historic precedent to look to is really it's the George Bush situation with breaking his promise, no new taxes, because that was so essential to him getting elected. That was the basis in many ways for his support among a lot of Republicans that were not comfortable with him otherwise. And if I wasn't clear, I meant George H.W. Bush in 92. And so I think Trump is in the same place, that he just cannot buckle on the issue that was so central in 2016.
So Sarah, I want to go back to Hal Rogers, the depressed veteran congressman from Kentucky. what happens next, do you think? Is there anything on the horizon that could that could cause some relief for him or other members of Congress who are thinking like, what's going on here?
Like, short answer, no.
Okay.
basically what most, and I spend my days talking mostly to folks in the House, so, you know, with that in mind, they do not think anything is going to be able to happen here until there is some kind of outside force. So the theory among a lot of Republicans on the Hill is that as soon as TSA starts actually striking and then airports are shut down, members of Congress would literally be stuck here because they can't go home. That is when people will be forced to come to the middle. And by that, I mean Trump and Pelosi, because everyone up here on the Hill is either blaming Trump or blaming Pelosi. There is almost no in between. They say there's not going to be an agreement until the two of those players can actually start compromising. And nobody up here thinks that's going to happen until something really big, really serious, something out of their hands can happen. So we saw a little bit with State of the Union. Pelosi is ramping up the pressure there. Mm-hmm. As Nancy was talking about earlier, Trump is actually trying to play his own games with keeping more parts of the government open. So he's doing his own maneuvers in that way. It's a real crazy situation. No one up here has ever seen anything like it, where there just is no path forward. Mm.
Well, and just two things to add to that. One, you know, I talked to someone in the Trump orbit this week who basically said that, you know, there is a theory among Republicans close to the White House and donors that Democrats will eventually cave because they will feel pressure from federal workers who live in Maryland or Virginia. Although there is a Pew Research poll that came out that shows that federal workers are sort of equally split between Republicans and Democrats. But there is a perception in the Trump orbit that they're all Democrats. And then two, I would say that, you know, I talked to a senior administration official about sort of the machinations of reopening different parts of the government in a piecemeal way and how that was going down. And this person made a very telling comment to me. The person said, well, you know, I'm not going to apologize for having us do things in a creative way. We want people to have their benefits in February. And I was like, but it's January. And so to me, that just signifies that they are thinking internally about this on a much longer time horizon than I am. I'm thinking about, like, let's get through the week. And they are thinking not just till the State of the Union, but actually what this could look like into the next month.
Oh, yeah. People up here are certainly talking long term about this, which is just what is so crazy. I mean, these are appropriators. These are supposed to be the most moderate, most sensible people in Congress. They're the ones in charge who actually have a job that has to get done every year. And they're saying, we don't know if we can even start writing next year's bills, next year's budget. Like, there's a ton of budget work that has to be done that's going to be all postponed. So it's just crazy. But also to add on what Nancy said, Democrats are saying this opposite thing about how Trump has miscalculated them. I mean, Democrats say they won this sweeping majority last November. They have absolutely zero incentive to compromise. And even talking to those who have a lot of federal workers in their district, they say, you know, I talk to federal employees. They don't want to be pawns in this fight. They don't want a wall at the end of this. So it's just messaging on both sides is just completely going past each other.
Well, and one former staff director of the House Appropriations Committee who I talked to yesterday for a story made a good point to me. He said, you know, the appropriations bill this year were supposed to be easy. You know, there's money on the table. The government boosted military and domestic spending. This was supposed to be an easy final set of appropriations bills that basically were mostly agreed to until Trump blew up the agreement right before Christmas. But looking ahead for fiscal year 2020, there's a lot more challenging things. There are budget caps that need to be adjusted and tweaked. There is the debt ceiling that needs to be raised. And if this is the fight that we're having over this set of appropriations bills in what should have been, you know, pretty easy, what's going to happen in the next fiscal year?
And meanwhile, you've got the campaigns for president, all those House members running for re-election,
right,
too, that are going to be heating up.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's going to be really fascinating to watch. I'm particularly curious if the TSA agents of the Washington area airports decide to take matters into their own hands, as you mentioned earlier, Sarah.
Mike Simpson of Idaho is very afraid that would happen. He said, I do not want to be stuck here.
Oh, man. Yeah, I'm just imagining a scene at the airport where a congressman is confronted by hundreds of angry travelers who are stranded there as well. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us to talk through it. We'll I'm sure we'll have more to talk about soon, since this doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Nancy, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Of course, anytime.
And Charlie, you're going to be sticking around for the next segment, so you do not get a goodbye. All right, and we're going to be joined now by Politico's national political reporter on the line from Chicagoland, Natasha Kurecki. Hi, Natasha. How you doing?
Hi, Scott. I'm good.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Our next data point that we're going to discuss with you is three. There are three more presidential candidates who have either declared exploratory committees or just leapt in and said they're running for president in just the last week. We've got Kirsten Gillibrand, who went on Stephen Colbert's show on Tuesday and launched an exploratory committee and actually just also said that she's running for president. So the whole exploratory thing is a charade, and maybe we'll talk about that some other time. But anyway, so Gillibrand's in. Julian Castro, who had previously launched an exploratory committee, announced his campaign in earnest in San Antonio over the weekend. And then Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, let slip on CNN. Let slip. I mean, it was probably planned. Whatever. Said on CNN that she's running for president. She hasn't filed any paperwork yet, but she says it's happening. So they're in. So, Natasha, It feels like it's crowded already, and we know there's a lot more coming. Does it feel crowded to you?
Yeah, it feels crowded. I mean, you know, the joke is raise your hand if you're a Democrat who's not thinking about running for president in 2020. but yeah, in reality, it's mid-January, and we've already had four, you know, add in Elizabeth Warren. We already have four pretty big names announced since New Year's Eve. And right, as you said, there's almost certainly, we know how much more crowded it's going to get. And how quickly that's going to happen. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker are almost certainly going to get in the next few weeks. You have lots of senators talking about Amy Klobuchar, Sherrod Brown, billionaire Michael Bloomberg's making news. And then all of that is before you even get to the three people who are leading all the early polls, which may or may not ultimately mean anything. But right now, Joe Biden, Beto O'Rourke, Bernie Sanders. So you quickly get to at least a dozen people. And it's, you know, you can say it's also just not the numbers. A lot of these names at least are, you know, pretty high caliber, higher profile contenders who have constituencies, they have, you know, some ability to raise money, a social media following. So, right, add all that up together, yes, it feels crowded.
How is that affecting the positioning so far? I mean, I've been really interested to see that basically everyone who's jumped in so far has taken kind of an anti-big money, anti-super PAC, some anti-PAC stance, right? You've got Elizabeth Warren kind of calling out billionaires and self-funders and saying she doesn't want super PAC support. Gillibrand, who has gotten a lot of criticism over her career for being too close to Wall Street as a senator from New York, came out and said the same thing at a press conference yesterday and has kind of set herself up for that over the last few years. Castro, same, no PAC. I've been very struck by that. Is there anything else that you're seeing in kind of the early maneuvering in how these candidates are positioning themselves against each other?
Right. Well, I mean, one thing with that that's interesting is that because Elizabeth Warren was first and, you know, she had the strategy, including a media strategy, she went on, you know, Maddow's show early on and she sort of issued this, you know, challenge. And so every time to not take super PAC funding, reject billionaire influence and self-funding. So every time a candidate now is saying that they reject it, Elizabeth Warren's taking credit for it, or at least trying to take credit for that.
And her allies certainly are.
Right. So, so you have that. And, you know, I think we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but it's, I think Warren just has had a huge advantage in going first, not just being first, but the way she executed being first. You know, she had not just have an exploratory apparatus up so she can lock down staffers and ramp up fundraising, but, you know, you could see that she had a strategy in place and a really strong team already around her. I mean, when you think about it, she unrolled her announcement on a Monday, which was New Year's Eve. And by Friday, she's on the ground in Iowa and lines are wrapped around the block and they're turning people away. So, you know, you need an organization to be able to turn people out like that.
Right.
And you know, she's the first one there and no one else is announced at that point. So she has everyone's undivided attention. She's able to tell her narrative, her hardscrabble life, growing up in Oklahoma, gives out her economic message. People are starting, you know, the Pocahontas stuff starting to fade a little bit, might come back, but it's fading a little bit. So you can really see that. I mean, now whether she keeps that momentum is another question. And Gillibrand's, of course, heading to Iowa this weekend. And I think it'll be telling to see if she can, you know, draw that kind of crowd, if she can animate people right off the bat as well.
Absolutely. No, that's a great question. I'm looking forward to seeing that myself. And it seems like Iowa Democrats want to be animated right now. I want to get back to that in a second. But Charlie, before we jump deeper into Iowa and what's going on there, I'm curious to get your thoughts about a couple of these other candidates who announced who you know, don't have that platform in the Senate that Gillibrand has had. Julian Castro, who was the HUD secretary and before that mayor of San Antonio, and then Tulsi Gabbard, who has been a fairly prominent for a member of the House, but one of 435 there. What's the kind of strategy there to get the ball rolling for their campaigns? It seems very, very different, but I know I'm especially interested in Castro because he's been spoken about as a rising star for so long.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of forces here that are worth talking about when we talk about these kinds of, you know, second or third tier candidates that you're referring to. I mean, first, it's important to just remember the backdrop. I mean, Democrats and Democratic public officials are energized and mobilized like never before because of Trump. And they also think that if he could be president, anybody can. And so that and then the rise of social media, the fragmented and atomized, segmented media landscape, the growth of online fundraising, all of that has enabled all of these folks to overcome the kinds of traditional obstacles and gatekeepers within the party that would have kept them from running in the past and traditionally kept fields pretty small. So all of that combines to create this enormous field. And I think the other point that's worth remembering and thinking about, you know, the so-called tiers of candidates is we have to remember that not everyone's really running for president. You know, some people are just kind of running for president. Meaning, as crass as it sounds, some people are running with other things in mind because they know it's a long shot or they don't really think they can get elected. They're running with either a cable TV gig in mind or they like to stay in the spotlight or they have their eye on the prize of the vice presidency, knowing that maybe they're a little bit too green and inexperienced and couldn't get the top job. But, you know, they have this ambitious plan of where they want to go in the future. So they want to be attractive candidates for the vice presidency come late summer 2020, or maybe, you know, book deals. I mean, there are lots of different reasons people would run for president in this era and that they wouldn't have done in the past.
Well, I'm curious to see what happens. I mean, the upshot of all this seems to be that, and, you know, again, we'll see what kind of reception Gillibrand gets. We'll see what some of the other candidates going to Iowa get. But judging from the outpouring of interest in Warren visiting a few weeks ago, it just seems like Democrats remain fired up for the next election, despite having won in 2018. And this is going to be one of the first places that we really get a chance to see the effects of that, both on the campaign and on the logistics of the campaign.
Right. I mean, I was with Warren in Iowa, and I mean, if there's one takeaway, it was people are ready. They just wanted to get going. So these long lines that you saw, you know, I talked to lots and lots of people, and they weren't Warren supporters per se. They were people who were, they just wanted it to get going. They wanted
that's interesting.
Hearing from everybody. Yeah.
That's just fascinating. Well, Natasha, thank you so much for joining to talk us through it. We'll have to have you back on after your next trip there to tell us what's new.
Okay, thank you.
And Charlie, thank you as always for
Scott,
joining
thanks
in the
so
studio.
Much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And of course, a big thank you to all of you for tuning in this week. Thank you so much for listening. Our producer is Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like the Nerdcast and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next week.